Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to welcome you here to Montreal to the joint Soli-Iali meeting. I'm in a minute going to introduce our speaker, Enrico Moretti, but before I do that, I want to say some thank yous to our superb organizers. First of all, Maggie Newman and Margot Romans have done just absolutely a terrific job. So we owe them a huge debt. Our local organizing committee, Danielle Perron and Fabian Lange, have also done a lot behind the scenes to help this go smoothly, and I'd also like to thank them. And we're fortunate enough to have several sponsors of our meeting: the Kauffman Foundation, the Cornell ILR School, HEC here in Montreal, and Elsevier have all contributed to making this a great meeting. So thank you very much for that. Okay, so our speaker, Enrico Moretti, is one of these people who really probably doesn't need much introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. So Enrico received his PhD from Berkeley in 2000 and has been a professor of economics there since 2008. Prior to that, he was one of my colleagues at UCLA, and before that, he was a social worker in the city of Cassano Magnano in Italy. He's won many awards, including the ICA Young Scholar Prize, the Carlo Alberto Medal for the Best Italian Economist Under 30, and Soli's Rosen Prize. His book, The New Geography of Jobs, won the William Bowen Prize for making the most important contribution to understanding public policy and the labor market. Enrico's early work estimated social returns to higher education. For example, his 2004 AER paper was the first to simultaneously estimate human capital externalities in both productivity and wages. This is arguably the best evidence we have on this important economic phenomena. This research on human capital externalities gave rise to several branches of literature, all of which have had positive externalities on the rest of us. One body of work looks at agglomeration economies, for example, using large plant openings or looking at the creation of the Tennessee Valley Authority to study the long-run effects of local economic development. A second branch of research looks at peer effects, including two very creative studies, one on peer effects in grocery store checkups, and another looking at how workers, in particular professors, react to knowing their coworkers' salaries. A third branch, which we've worked on together, examines the long-term effects of investments in maternal human capital. This work has all come together in the study of place-based policies, that is, economic policies directed at locations rather than people or industrial sectors. And that's what we're going to be hearing more about today. So please join me in welcoming Enrico and looking forward to his talk.
Thank you, Janet, for this warm introduction. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Let me turn on this thing.
Today, I would like to talk about space, not in the sense of the moon or the stars or celestial bodies, but in the much more prosaic sense of geography. My interest in economic geography stems from the observation that economic activity is very unevenly distributed over space. In the US, for example, there are large and growing differences across metro areas in pretty much any labor market outcome we can measure. And this is a similar unevenness is observed in many countries for which we have geocoded data. In the US, for example, we see vast differences in human capital across cities. We see vast differences in the type of employers they locate in different cities. For example, the type of industries or how much these employers invest in innovation. We also see vast differences in total factor productivity, in labor productivity, and most importantly, in wages, which is what I'm going to focus on today. Interestingly, these differences do not appear to go away over time. Indeed, in the US, they've been growing for 3 decades. And so what I want to argue today is that the uneven localization of economic activity has fundamental implications for our understanding of the labor market in particular, and more in general, of the broader economy. And I'm going to be talking about some of the results that have emerged in what I consider a growing and exciting literature, which is at the intersection of labor economics and urban economics. It's a literature that has embraced a lot of the big questions that regional and urban economics have asked in the 60s and the 70s, and has made some strides in trying to provide some evidence on these questions. In particular, I would like to first provide a positive analysis with a specific focus on why is the spatial distribution of economic activity, and in particular, why is the spatial distribution of nominal wages so uneven within a country and is becoming more and more uneven over time. And then I would like to spend the bulk of my lecture on providing a normative analysis, focusing on some new work that I just finished with Chang Tai-shi, which asks the question, is the spatial distribution of economic activity in the US optimal? And in the paper, which is available online from our webpage, we argue that it's far from optimal. We argue that the spatial distribution of labor is constrained by important barriers. In particular, by the housing supply regulation set by high-wage, high-productivity cities like San Francisco and New York. These cities have been blessed by high TFP, so workers are extremely productive there, but they have decided to erect barriers around their borders in the form of housing supply regulation. And these barriers essentially limit the number of U.S. workers who have access to the high-productivity in these cities. And in the paper, we estimate that the costs for the overall economy in the U.S. are large. They're not in the billions. They're actually in the trillions, if you believe our setup. And most importantly, that under some assumption, there are good reason to think that these are not just output losses, but also welfare losses for the American worker. Let me start with some facts. Here, I'm showing my estimates of economic output per square kilometer in the U.S., and as you can see, the distribution of output is extremely uneven, with big peaks corresponding to some of the denser metro areas and an ocean of very little output being produced. By my estimate, if you were to drop 70% of the landmass of the U.S., U.S. GDP wouldn't change all that much. Of course, human capital is also very unevenly distributed. This is the share of workers with a college degree. The difference here between the dark areas and the white areas are enormous. So the darkest area include metro areas where 40 to 50% of the workers have a college degree or more. The light areas are areas where between 10 and 15% of workers have a college degree or more. So we're talking about between the top areas and the bottom areas, we're talking about of a difference around 4 to 1. Just to put this in perspective, this is much larger than the difference in human capital that we see between the U.S. as a whole and poor developing countries like Peru or Bolivia. There are also enormous differences in employers, in the type of firms that locate in different areas, and in particular in how much they invest in innovation. You can look at difference in R&D. In this specific map, I'm looking at difference in patents per work, citation-weighted patents per worker. And here, the concentration is even more, is even higher than the previous maps. In fact, if you were to drop 95% of the land mass in the U.S., patent production wouldn't change all that much. And finally, nominal wages, which is the focus of this lecture. Here I'm showing conditional log earnings in 2009 in cities with high log earnings and cities with low conditional earnings. Here I'm conditioning on a set of covariates that include schooling, race, ethnicity, age, gender, as well as union status. And what the table shows is that the metro areas with the highest conditional earnings in 2009 were places like San Jose, New York City, San Francisco, Trenton, Seattle, Boston, and Washington, D.C. At the bottom, you have Muncie, Sharon, Daytona, Gadsden, Danville, El Paso, McAllen, and Brownsville. The difference between the top and the bottom, between San Jose and Brownsville, is more than twice the annual earnings. So a worker with the same level of schooling, the same demographics, the same work experience, the same union status can make more than twice as much in nominal wages in San Jose relative to Brownsville. Now, I should say that the dispersion in nominal wages is a fairly robust in including an increasingly larger number of axes. And it's also robust in including worker fixed fat when you use longitudinal data following workers from one city to another. If you do that in the geocoded version of the NLSY. Of course, the NLSY, the sample size for each city is so tiny that the results are not, you know, that they're noisy. But the broader picture survives worker fixed effects. Now, remarkably, these differences are not going away. In fact, these differences have been increasing over time. You see that in college share, which have grown faster in cities that started off with high college share, between 1980 and 2009. You see that in conditional average wages, which have grown faster in cities that started off with high nominal wages. And you see that in innovation, which at least for the period that I have data for, 2002, 2012, have also become more concentrated. So in some sense, US cities are not converging. They're actually diverging. Contrary to the 1980 literature on convergence, Barrow and Sally Martin have a series of paper that looks at state. Actually, the evidence point to clear evidence of divergence in nominal wages and other important labor market outcomes. This is the evidence on divergence for college share on the top and earnings of college graduates at the bottom. These are changes since 1980 for the top 10 cities and the bottom 10 cities in 1980. A better way to look at the divergence in wages is this one, which I'm going to use later in the paper with Chang. This is the special dispersion of the mean log residual. In 1964, which is the earliest year I could get data on, in 2009, weighted by the employment in the relevant year. What you see is that already in 1964, the U.S. was not spatially equal, in the sense that even in 1964, there were cities that were rich in nominal wage terms, and cities that were poor. And again, I should have said, this is, again, conditional on the same axis as before. So schooling, demographics, and ethnicity, race, age, gender, and union status. I was just saying, in 1964, it's not like the U.S. was spatially equal. There were cities with high conditional wages and cities with low conditional wages. But it was much more equal than today. If you look at the dispersion today, in red, it's twice as wide as the dispersion then. And in particular, you should focus on the right tail, and in particular on that bump in the right tail, which includes three important cities in this story, New York, San Francisco, and San Jose, which started off with high conditional wages already in 64, but have grown tremendously and are now essentially almost outside the graph. This table quantifies the increase in dispersion, and I'm showing the standard deviation across cities, interquantile range, and range. And what you see is that the standard deviation in the log conditional wage has increased from 0.10 to 0.18. The interquantile range is essentially double for 0.12 to 0.24. And the range has increased from 0.7 to 0.9, mostly driven by those high-wage cities. So clearly, we live in a country that is where spatial inequalities are increasing across cities, at least in terms of nominal wages. You also see similar trends in other countries. For example, there is evidence in the UK that starting since 2000 to now, wages in London have grown faster than wages in other parts of the country. This is extremely clear in Sweden, where Stockholm is booming and nominal wages are growing very, very fast. But then in the northern of the country is shrinking. It's also true in developing countries. Like China, obviously, has grown tremendously starting in the last decade or 15 years. But the wages have grown much faster in places like Shanghai or Beijing than in more isolated community in Western China. It's also true in India, where places like Bangalore have experienced much faster increases in labor productivity and nominal wages than rural part of India like Bihar. So we live in a funny, interesting period where we've seen convergence in income level across countries, with countries like India and China catching up or like growing faster than developed countries in Europe and in America. But then we see divergence within countries across cities, at least for some countries for which we have data. Okay. So what causes the growing difference in labor market outcomes and in particular in nominal wages across U.S. cities? I'm going to now focus mostly on the U.S., which is where I've done most of my work on. Well, I'm going to argue that these growing differences reflect the combination of two factors. Exogenous shift in labor demand, mostly driven by shock across industries, and endogenous agglomeration economies. The first factor, and this is just part of the story, obviously, it's not the entire story, but I think in my book I argue that the decline of traditional industry and the rise of industry that make intensive use of human capital have played an important role in differentially affecting different cities in the U.S. The decline of traditional industry, it's obviously seen here when you look at employment in manufacturing. This is number of production jobs in the U.S. manufacturing sector starting in 1985. It's a pretty flat negative trend, and then it has a slope of minus 380,000 per year. At the same time, where we're losing this type of jobs, some industries were experiencing pretty good times. This is employment in some human capital industries. The top is internet, and the bottom is software. My data actually stopped when I started writing a book, which was 2009. I bet if I included right now, the internet jobs would probably be twice as high as in the graph. I would need a much larger graph to include the boom in internet employment. Software is also increasing very, very fast. People keep complaining about software jobs moving to Bangalore, but the software industry in the U.S. keep growing at a pace that is much faster than the rest of the labor market by an order of magnitude. Scientific R&D is also growing very fast. Pharmaceutical is going less fast, but more in a more steady pace. These are just some examples. But of course, that cannot be the entire story, because sure, it is the case that manufacturing decline has hurt Detroit more than other places, and is it the case that increase in internet has helped San Francisco more than other places? But we still need a story for why these companies are agglomerating where they are. It's pretty obvious that human capital intensive industries tend to be heavily, spatially clustered. The clearest example is biotech. Essentially, three-quarters of employment in biotech is concentrated in five cities: Boston, San Francisco, San Diego, Raleigh-Durham, and Washington, D.C. Software and internet are not as heavily concentrated, but clearly the key cluster here are San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, and Austin. Finance has traditionally been concentrated in New York and Stanford. The new industry of digital entertainment that didn't exist 20 years ago is mostly concentrated in three places: Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, within the U.S. By the way, Montreal is a nascent cluster in digital entertainment outside the US. So how can this be an equilibrium? Why firms in the traded sector that presumably compete nationally or internationally are willing to locate in these high-cost cities? Because their customers are not in those cities. The firms in software, they sell their software pretty much everywhere in the world. Why do they locate in San Francisco, where they pay labor more than twice as much as alternative location? And when they pay their office space, probably three times as much as this alternative location. What keeps them attracting there? Because the share of San Francisco keeps increasing. And if you come to San Francisco now, it looks like a boom town, and it's all driven by those industries. Why does Google locate in these places? I was just talking with Al Varian the other day. He's a former colleague, and now he's chief economist at Google, and he was telling me all the locations where Google has open offices. And he basically looked all the locations at the top of the high wages that I showed before in the U.S., and the most expensive location internationally, Zurich and London. And when they do pick a developing countries, it's Shanghai, it's never Western China, or it's Bangalore, it's never rural India. What is so attractive to human capital intensive firms in these places, given that labor costs and housing costs are so expensive, and given that they sell a good that has no transportation costs? Google transportation costs are literally zero. And I think here there's a growing literature that points to the fact that industry cluster offer some important productivity advantages in the form of agglomeration economies. There is the idea of labor pooling is probably very important. So the importance of thick labor market is probably very important, especially when labor is very heterogeneous and firms' need are very heterogeneous and labor is very specialized. Having a thick market probably allows a better match between workers, very heterogeneous worker, and very heterogeneous need of firms. So the value of the match is likely to be higher in a cluster where everybody else is concentrated. Notice that this works for specialized labor. It doesn't work if you are a welder or a janitor, because in that case, if labor is completely homogeneous, it doesn't really work. The power of the match doesn't really, the value of the match doesn't really vary with thickness. And then there is human capital spillovers. Janet was referring to some of the earlier literature on this topic. But it's clear that if you go to these firms and you talk with people in Silicon Valley, that's the first thing that they tell you, is how important it is for them to be near their competitors to see where the new ideas are. And I tried to measure this thing with some of the work that Janet was mentioning. But when you actually visit this firm, it actually becomes very, very clear. It becomes visually clear why that matters. Let me just give you an example of one paper that I've written that tries to quantify the importance of agglomeration economies. This is the million-dollar paper with Michael Greenstone and Rick Ornbeck, where we try to quantify the importance of agglomeration economies, addressing the obvious identification issues that arise. Because obviously, it's very hard to quantify these things. You can't really compare San Francisco with Brownsville and assume that everything else is constant. Because there are many reasons why firms might find San Francisco attractive relative to Brownsville, or many reasons why workers might find it attractive, irrespective of the productivity advantages offered by cluster. So in that paper, we use the location rankings of firms that seek to open a new plant. These firms typically start by looking at hundreds of potential locations, and then they narrow down the list to a dozen, then they further narrow down the list to, say, three or four, then they pick two finalists, and then finally they pick a winner. In that paper, we compare the counties that won this competition with counties that survived this long selection process and made it to the finalist list but barely lost, the runner-ups, and we call them the losing county. And what we do, we compare incumbent plants in counties where the new plant ultimately chose to locate with incumbent plants in runner-up counties. And what we find is that incumbent plants that were in the winner county experienced large, economically meaningful, and statistically significant increase in TFP. This is the key picture from the paper. It shows the TFP level of incumbents in the winner and the losing county in the 7 years before the plant opening and it's 7 years after the plane opening in the top graph. And then the bottom graph shows you the difference, okay, which is probably the clearest evidence. What it shows you is that TFP trends were similar in winning counties and losing counties for incumbent plants, but they start diverging right after the opening of the new plant. And by year five, there is a 6% difference in TFP for incumbent plants in the winning county relative to the losing county. Interestingly, we also find that spillovers depend not just on economic, on geographical distance, but also on economic distance. In particular, we find that spillovers are larger for a pair of firms that share workers, where there is a larger flow of workers. And also for pair of firms with similar technologies. So we conclude that this is at least prima facie evidence consistent with model of agglomeration economies where labor pooling and human capital spillovers might be important. But this is clear an area that requires more work. I think a lot of the literature points to the existence of agglomeration economies, but understanding the macro mechanisms that generate the agglomeration economies is still really important, and the evidence is still scarce. Now, how can this be an equilibrium for workers? I just asked the question, how can this be an equilibrium for firms? The flip side is, why are workers not moving to these high-wage cities in larger numbers? It has long been understood, at least since Roebuck seminal papers or the Rosen-Roebuck model, as some people call it, that if labor is mobile, differences in utility cannot be as large as differences in nominal wages. And part of the difference here, part of the adjustment here is the price of non-tradables, in particular the price of land, which will endogenously adjust in high-wage cities. In other words, more concretely, the reason why there's still people in Brownsville and they have not all moved to San Jose is probably the fact that cost of living is very high in San Jose, and so that utility differences are not as large as the nominal wage differences that I show in the previous table. In the Rosen-Roebuck model, the simplest version, if labor is infinitely mobile and housing is infinitely fixed, then all the benefit of high wages in a location end up in the pocket of landowners in that location. In a more realistic model, where labor is mobile but not infinitely mobile, and housing supply can be adjusted by building more housing, then there is a split of the benefit of economic growth between landowners and workers. And that split depends on which of the two factors is more mobile. In new work with Rick Hornbeck, we're estimating the incidence of increase in labor demand caused by increase in TFP, in local TFP, to try to determine what's the split between landowners and workers. In particular, we use the same confidential plant level data that we use in the $1 million plant paper to directly measure TFP shocks at the plant level. We aggregate them up at the city level, and then we measure what's the effect of TFP shocks on wages and cost of living. And what we find is that most of the beneficiaries, two-thirds of the added output generated by productivity growth ends up in the pocket of landowners, and a third is captured by workers in the forms of higher real wages. We also find that the effect of a skill-neutral TFP shock on the local wages is larger for high school graduates than college graduates. And this makes a lot of sense because college graduates are much more mobile. So the local effect of the local TFP shocks is for college graduates is more muted on their wages just because there is much more mobility for them and is much more pronounced for high school graduates that are less mobile. So we conclude in the paper that local increases in TFP compress wage inequality at the local level. Okay. Now, I want to turn to what is supposed to be the main topic here. Let me check the time. Which is a normative analysis. So far, I've argued that the spatial distribution of economic activity in the U.S. is highly uneven, one. Two, that is becoming more uneven over time. And three, that this is probably something to do with industry-wide shocks and the clustering of industries across local labor markets. Now I would like to turn to the normative question of is the spatial distribution of economic activity in the U.S. optimal? And I would like to report some of the results of a new paper that we just finished with Chiang Kai-shek, where we argue that it's actually far from optimal. So last night I had all the equation here, but then I realized this was going to be a lunch talk. So instead of boring you with the equations, I'm going to give you the intuition of the model, and I'm going to refer you to the paper for the formal analysis. But I think I can convey the intuition fairly easily. It's actually a pretty intuitive notion. Why would a growing spatial distribution in nominal wages be could be inefficient or suboptimal? Well, the idea here is that nominal wages are a good proxy for the marginal product of labor. We know that from the first order conditions that a firm faces. The fact that nominal wages in San Jose are twice as high as nominal wages in Brownsville probably reflects the fact that the marginal worker hired in San Jose is twice as productive as the marginal worker hired in Brownsville, for whatever reason. I argued earlier that probably this reflects some endogenous agglomeration economy. But for whatever reason, if nominal wages are twice as high in San Jose than Brownsville, it must be that the marginal worker is twice as productive. Otherwise, traded sector firms would not locate in San Jose. Which implies that the, you know, the differences in the marginal product of labor over space imply that this allocation of labor over space is inefficient in the sense that it does not maximize output. In fact, if the marginal product of labor in San Jose is twice as high as the marginal product of labor in Brownsville, you should start, and if you wanted to maximize GDP in the U.S., you start moving people from Brownsville to San Jose. And if you are in the business of maximizing U.S. GDP only, you should keep that reallocation up to the point where the marginal product of labor is equalized across all cities. So this means that the fact that, you know, that picture that I showed earlier with the increase in the spatial distribution of wages implies that the U.S. is increasingly experiencing output losses coming from the inefficient distribution of labor. And what we're going to focus on is the reason for these output losses. Why do we see an increase in the spatial distribution of marginal product of labor? Why isn't labor flowing more toward these high TFP, high marginal product of labor locations like San Jose, San Francisco, New York? And the key answer, which I anticipated, will be housing regulations. Let me tell you how we get there. What we do, well, we obviously need a model to quantify output losses and welfare losses. And we take the standard spatial equilibrium model and we extend it and we aggregate it at the national level. We make a set of standard assumptions. The first one is that workers can move freely across cities and they can locate where utility is maximized. Utility, just like in Robach, Rosen-Robach, is indirect utility is a function of nominal wages in that city, amenities, Z, in that city, and then P is the rent, is the cost of living in that city, to the power beta, and beta is the share that the household, the average worker spend on housing, which is about a third of the typical budget. We also assume that each city produces a traded good that is sold on the national market. Capital is supplied with infinite elasticity. And then we have to model the housing market, which is crucial in this setting. We assume that each worker consumes one unit of housing, so people don't adjust housing consumption. Everybody needs one unit of housing. And then crucially, that the supply of housing is governed by city regulations that can determine how elastic is housing supply. So in cities like Houston or Indianapolis, where you can build as much as you want, there is no constraint, that housing supply is very elastic. In cities like San Francisco or New York, where it's really hard to add housing units, that housing supply is very low. So that's very standard in the Rosen-Robach model. What we do that is novel, we aggregate it up at the country level. So we derive an expression for aggregate output and aggregate welfare as a function of local variables in equilibrium. And then we use that model and together with data on 220 metro areas in the U.S., to ask two questions. What are the output losses from the increase in the spatial the increase in the variation in nominal wages, and what are the welfare losses? In particular, we ask, on the first question, we ask what would happen to output if we could reduce the spatial dispersion of wages, but we kept constant TFP in each city. Okay, so essentially, we're trying to hold constant labor demand in each city and shift the exogenous determinants of labor supply to the point that reduce the dispersion of nominal wages. And we chose 1964 as a good starting point. We decided, originally we had a counterfactual where we were eliminating spatial dispersion in nominal wages, but we figured that would not be very informative. There's no state, there's no country in the world that has no variation in nominal wages, nor there is any period in history where the U.S. had no variation in nominal wages. Instead, our counterfactual is we bring back the dispersion in nominal wages to what used to be in 1964, which I showed you at the beginning was much more compressed. It was a distribution that with half of the standard deviation. And these are the results. In the first row, we show that the counterfactual output would be 13.5% higher, and about 52% of the U.S. workers would relocate. To picture this in your mind, we're essentially moving people from low nominal wage cities to high nominal wage cities. And so we are increasing the size of the most productive parts of the U.S. and shrinking the size of the least productive part of the U.S. to mimic the wage distribution that we saw in 1964, holding constant TFP that we observe today. This is a huge effect on output. Just to put this in perspective, this would be the equivalent of $1.9 trillion yearly in additional output and income, or 1.2, given that this is a crowd of labor economists, $1.2 trillion in additional wage bill. Or, assuming labor supply fixed, about 8,700 additional annual dollars in salary per worker. Okay, so it's a massive effect from spatially reallocating labor from the least productive part of the country to the most productive part of the country. Maybe it's too big of an effect in the sense that maybe we're talking about a counterfactual that it's implausible. We're, shifting 50% of the labor force in the U.S. is probably not a policy that will get implemented easily. I can provide partial adjustments, which may be a little bit more realistic. Here, I'm scaling partial adjustment based on how many people are implied by the counterfactual, how many people need to change their metropolitan area of residence under the counterfactual. And we think that row 5 is a plausible benchmark. In row 5, 20% of U.S. workers change location, and this would yield still a huge increase in U.S. GDP, about 6.5% additional GDP. The reason why this is not implausible as a benchmark is that about 20% of U.S. families change MSA every 15 years. So this is not something that would take a century to occur, but it could occur in a finite amount of time. Now, let me show you what would happen to U.S. cities. Let's focus on the partial adjustment case in column 2. This is the counterfactual employment change in cities that experience large increases and cities that would experience large decreases. At the top, of course, is New York City, that in the partial adjustment case would increase by 179%. San Jose would increase by 149%. My hometown would increase by 147%. And by the way, this is the metro area. We're not talking about the county or the municipality. We're talking about the metro area. So this would be the increase in the San Francisco metro area, not just the city. It's not implausible, by the way, the Bay Area, the ABAG, which is the Association of Bay Area Government, put out a planning document on how to deal with the increasing demand for housing in the Bay Area. And their recommendation was that Bay Area government should increase number of housing units by 80% by 2040. So it's not the 147% that I in my column two, but it's not very, very far off. The median city in the U.S. under this scenario would shrink by 32%. It's Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And then there are cities that essentially would disappear from the map, like Flint or Sharon, Pennsylvania, would shrink by 77 or 78%, respectively. Now, obviously, output losses are not welfare losses. The welfare implications depend on, really, what is limiting labor supply to high-wage cities. Or more concretely, why aren't there more workers who leave Brownsville and move to places like New York, San Francisco, and San Jose? And there are, in the model, there are two alternative possibilities, and they have profoundly different welfare implications. The first possibility is that, or actually, I should craft the question better. Why are workers not moving to these high-wage cities the same way that they used to in 1964? Because that's really the counterfactual that we have. It's like bringing back the U.S., the distribution of labor supply, local labor supply in the U.S. to the level of 1964. Why is that not happening more? And there are two possible alternatives. One is that between 1964 and 2009, the elasticity of housing supply of American cities have become, in particular of the cities with high wages and high TFP, has become much less elastic because cities have become much more restrictive in the number of housing permits they give out. In this case, if that's the explanation for the high nominal wages in places like San Francisco, San Jose, New York, is that there is strong labor demand, and then there is very little housing supply, and so workers need to be compensated for living there because there is no housing units, and rents are sky high, then the output losses that I just documented translate into welfare losses, pretty substantial welfare losses. But there's also another possibility, is that workers are not willing to move to the cities because of amenities. Maybe they dislike living in crowded, congested, noisy places like New York. Maybe increasingly so relative to 1964. So what we do is to try to differentiate between these two hypotheses, because if the first is true, then the output losses that I put up translate into welfare losses. If the second is true, it's the output losses that I estimated don't translate into welfare losses. And the last thing you want to do is to bring even more people to places that aren't desirable to live in. So if people don't like to live in New York because it's crowded and congested more than in 64, you could bring people there. Output in the U.S. would increase, but aggregate welfare would decline because that's not where people like to live. As it turns out, we're going to find that most of it has to do with land use regulation. And what are these land use regulations? Well, you know, one thing to note is that the housing market is one of the most regulated markets in the U.S. economy. I don't think there is many other markets where supply is essentially determined by the government. In growing markets like San Francisco, essentially stringent land use regulation decide how many housing units get produced every year. For example, right now, the San Francisco County has added 20,000 new jobs in the last 12 months, but the San Francisco Planning Department has issued only 1,000 new housing permits. Okay, so the discrepancy between the demand for housing and the supply of new housing is enormous, and the binding factor is land use regulations. Now, some of these land use regulations make a lot of sense. You don't want skyscraper in the residential neighbors where all the other houses are one floor. But some of these land use regulations make no sense. There's at least a third of San Francisco County which is completely underutilized, where you could build more, but where there is strong opposition on the part of residents to building more. My wife actually works for the San Francisco Planning Department, so I actually hear a lot of the stories from her. And yes, in some cases, planning land use regulation are actually optimal in the sense that take into account negative externalities. You certainly don't need, you cannot, you know, when you, once you put up a high building, some people lose light, some people lose views, some people lose, you know, congestion might increase. But there is in San Francisco, probably one of the most expensive real estate markets in the world, right now there's a third of land that is completely zoned out by, from residential development, purely because arbitrary land use regulations. And the same is true in other places like San Jose and even New York. One way in which we can measure land use regulation is the Wharton Residential Land Use Regulatory Index, which was collected by Joe Gourkiu and other people at Wharton, where they go out and ask municipalities about all sorts of questions about the planning process, the entitlement process, the appeal process, which is crucial. And then they come out with a number that shows how far out San Francisco, New York, San Jose, and other high-wage cities are in terms of restraining housing supply. So what we do, we compute the counterfactual output under the assumption that land use regulations in high-wage cities, high TFP cities, like New York, San Francisco, and San Jose, are brought down to the level of the median U.S. city, holding constant geography, of course. I mean, obviously, you cannot expand land infinitely. In San Francisco, the land is fixed. New York land is fixed. You know, there is oceans, there is hills. But what we're doing in our experiment, we're holding constant the geography, but and we are relaxing land use regulations to the level, to the plausible level of the median U.S. city. And what we find in row one is that that would generate, that would explain most of the increase in output that we found in our first counterfactual. So lowering land use regulation in New York, San Francisco, and San Jose to the level of the median U.S. city would increase U.S. output by more than 9%. We also do another counterfactual, which is interesting. We increase land regulation in the South to the level of San Francisco, New York, and San Jose. Southern cities are notorious for not regulating development. You know, Houston, oddly, it's the extreme case where essentially there's no constraint. You can add every person who show up in Houston who wants to move to Houston, you can add an housing unit there one-to-one. Constraining housing regulation in the South would reduce U.S. output by our estimate would reduce U.S. GDP by 3%. So the bottom line of the paper, and now I'm getting close to the question and answer period. The bottom line of the paper is that the spatial distribution of labor in the U.S. is inefficient, we conclude. We conclude that output gains from spatial relocation of labor are probably substantial, that if wages were set back to their 1964 level, GDP in the U.S. would and everything else was held constant. I should say this more precisely. If relative wages were set back to the 1964 level and everything else was constant, specifically TFP levels were held constant on 2009 level, then U.S. GDP would increase by 13%. This would add almost $2 trillion to the U.S. economy and almost $9,000 to the average worker's salaries. Most importantly, these are not just output losses, they are likely to be welfare losses. Most of the increasing wages does not seem to reflect undesirable local amenities in these high-wage, high-TFP cities. It actually reflects constraint to mobility of housing, constraint to the mobility of American workers that are implicit in housing supply regulations in the most productive of U.S. cities. What are the policy implications? Well, this is a situation where incumbent workers in highly productive cities, like New York and San Francisco, choose stringent land use regulations which restrict housing supply in those cities. And they're essentially preventing more of American workers to access their high level of TFP. And in general equilibrium, this is a negative externality that essentially lowers welfare for all American workers. In our model, remember, there's mobility. So this lowers the level of utility for everybody in the U.S., irrespective of where they live. In some sense, it's not unlike a negative externality of the type of a polluting plant in Ohio that pollutes New York. So one policy implication is just like in the same way that the federal government constrained the ability of Ohio power plants to pollute the sky and then through wind negatively affected New York citizens, One possible policy would be to allow the federal government to constrain the ability of local municipalities, especially those with high nominal wages and high TFP level, to restrict their housing supply. Now, it's unlikely that this is ever going to happen, because that would mean that the federal government tells cities how much they can build and where. A more plausible policy implication, though, is to vastly expand the network of public transportation that links high-wage cities to low-wage cities. Here, one important example is the high-speed train that is being built in California. That train was conceived as a way to link San Francisco to Los Angeles and compete with the plane. The reality is that if our model is correct, if our findings are correct, the most consequential aspect of building an high-speed train would not be to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles. It would be to connect San Francisco with the low-wage cities in the Central Valley, the places like Sacramento, Stockton, Merced, Tracy, places where nominal wages are probably a third of what you see in San Francisco downtown. Essentially, doubling overnight labor supply to San Francisco downtown without changing housing supply in San Francisco. This would, in our argument, would benefit the U.S. economy overall by increasing the number of U.S. workers who have access to the high TFP that reside in San Francisco downtown. This is not unlike what we see in places like the U.K. or Japan. You know, if you think about London, the London region, the people are traveling from the far outskirts of the region to London downtown to have access to those high nominal wages in London downtown. Our argument is that that helps the GDP of the U.K., doesn't just help those workers, but helps everybody in spatial equilibrium. The same true in Tokyo. People are traveling by train from very far distances to have access to those high-paying, high-nominal wage, high TFP jobs in Tokyo. So let me conclude. My main message is that the issue of uneven localization of economic activity has important implications for economists, for our understanding of the labor market, and for our broader understanding of the economy. There is a field or a subfield at the intersection of labor and urban that has courageously tried to address some of the big questions that regional economies have raised in the 60s and the 70s. And they failed to address because at the time the data weren't there, at the time the econometrics techniques weren't there, at the time people couldn't solve the endogeneity problems. And so there is a small but exciting and growing subfield that I think is trying to address questions of fundamental importance. And some of these questions are of positive nature. Most of them are of positive nature, and some of these questions are of normative nature. So, and I hope that this lecture might induce some people here, especially the graduate student, to take on some of these important questions. Thank you very much. And I think we have some time for questions now. Janet.
I can bring this microphone to people who want to ask questions so that people can hear the questions. But I was just going to ask, you focused on federal responses, and I wondered how close you could come to an optimum by considering state-level responses, because a place, as you were mentioning, in California, there's both high wage and low wage within California, similarly in New York.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you could go a great deal. That's much more plausible politically, and you could do a great deal. There is already a lot of state-level constraints on municipalities on building affordable housing. So, for example, municipalities in California are forced by the state of California or are incentivated and up to a point and then forced to build affordable housing in small numbers. So one could, in principle, conceive extending those policy to more broadly allow for more market rate housing, not just affordable housing. So I think that would be more politically feasible, and it's a good idea. It's a good suggestion.
If you have a question.
I'm not familiar with the U.S. Municipal taxation rule, but in Israel, for example, cities are not interested in expanding because they lose money on people coming in. They make money on firms coming in. And the taxation on companies is much higher than the taxes on individuals. So there is an inbuilt system where they won't build and just try to get lucrative firms coming in. The other question is, you made a distinction between landowners and workers, but in 70% of the cases, the workers are the owners of their own apartments, and therefore they have no incentive to see the real estate values going down.
Yeah, I agree on the distinction between renters and landowners. Workers and landowners is for intellectual clarity. But of course, the two figures are obviously they overlap in 65 to 70% of the cases in the U.S. It's just that it helps to think about the incidence of say a TFP shocks when you separate where the incidence is coming from. Is it coming from wages or is it coming from the value of your asset? On the first question, in the U.S., this is not the case that cities make money from attracting outside firms. In fact, in many cases, the opposite. The cities actually pay incentives for firms to locate in their jurisdiction, and most of the taxes are not captured. Most of the corporate taxes are not captured by cities. In fact, I'm not aware of any fraction of corporate taxes that are captured by cities.
Yeah, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, and it seems just to follow up on this sort of question of whose incentives there are in San Francisco. Living outside of San Francisco, people don't get to vote on how things are going to be allocated. In Detroit, you could vote a high set of pensions and expecting it to be paid by future residents who subsequently left the jurisdiction and didn't pay the taxes. There are a lot of wedges with our local politics. Is there a way of making sort of politics that's local be optimal?
Well, that's the crux of the problem. That's indeed why we have the problem, is the fact that we have a potential large externality that doesn't get internalized by the local voters. The San Francisco voters will only vote. They have an incentive. It's actually restricting on supply. Certainly the homeowners do. Because they don't take into account all the potential benefit that would come from allowing more American workers to access the TFP that was blessed upon them by the tech boom. And that's indeed the crux of the problem. That's why I was invoking there's two solutions. Either federal constraints that could curtail the ability of local voters to set their own land use regulation in too stringent ways, or short of that, federal subsidies to build a network of transportation network that can allow workers to access those high TFP, high wage jobs, irrespective of location, or at least obviously we cannot have a train that goes from Florida to San Francisco, but that could relax that constraint, could allow more workers to access high TFP jobs, high wage jobs, living in areas that are outside the San Francisco metro area or outside the New York metro area, outside the Boston metro area. But indeed, that's the crux of the problem.
Okay. I have one remark and one question. I would argue that not geography matters, but networks matter, in fact, that geography is usually just a term we use. What we actually mean is networks matter, especially in the spatial econometrics literature. When we talk about spatial autocorrelation, and we usually mean we measure some kind of network effect. So unless we're talking about resources, then I would rather say we talk about networks. And my question is, have you looked at micro-level explanations, for example, whether the behavior we see is optimal for firms or individual persons? Because as far as I understood you, you're focusing on the macro level, focusing on wages, whether people work, move or not. But for me, there seem to be a lot of reasons why, for example, firms are there in these high-wage areas, not only because people coming there because they can attract the best working people, for example, and also that we have restricted housing, like already some people said. We have that because people like to have high-valued houses. People don't like to have a lot of competition in the labor market, for example. If you earn a high wage, then you don't want any more people coming in who might destroy your wage.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I was clear on the first part. I wasn't clear on the second part. So in terms of networks, network might matter. I don't know. It's a vague term, but they might or might not matter. What I'm focusing here is, if network matters, is the local component of networks. In other words, if network matter for agglomeration economies, if they are an important component of agglomeration economies, I'm capturing them in my analysis, which is based on location. There's certainly networks that extend outside the boundaries of a metro area. For example, it's possible that human capital spillovers occurs not just locally, but also globally across networks of scientists or of peers. Some of the work that has been that has been done recently by a number of U.S. Of Berkeley students actually points indeed in that direction. That for very highly specialized workers, networks are not just geographical but also intellectual. And so the co-authors that you work with benefit from your human capital, even if they are far away, and this has measurable impact on the patent, on the productivity, on the number of patents filed by firms that share network of co-authors. But that doesn't. I have no problem in believing that. All I'm saying is that there's a very important geographical component of networks, and that's what I was focusing on today.
Okay, so. We have about 5 minutes to get to our 2 o'clock sessions. So let's thank Enrico once again.
Thank you, John.